This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Body Bags with Joseph Scott Morgan. To lose someone whom you love is one of the toughest things that a human being will ever endure. I know that for a fact because I've had loved ones that have passed on. And I've also been present when I have had to tell people that their loved ones have passed on. But, you know, some say that next to a death of a loved one, that a divorce is one of the most brutal things a human being can go through. You tie a lot of emotion up in it because you see perhaps a failure. You see an end to things that you thought had great possibilities. And there it just crumbles right before you. And of course, the really sad part is not necessarily going your own way from the person that you thought you were going to spend the rest of your life with. But if you have children, they're left in the wake many times to be battered up against the metaphorical rocks of life. Today, we're going to talk about one such child. And this case is special to me because it's a case that I covered early on in my media career, and it impacted me, I think, probably like no other. Today, we're going to talk about the murder of Dylan Redwine. I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bags. Dave, you know, when you're a little boy, and you and I used to be little boys, we spent our time playing and having adventures, getting together with our friends, tossing a ball around. Some of the coolest times that you can experience. But I know that for myself, I am a child of divorce. And you pay a price for it, don't you? I mean, it's not just mom and dad that might pay a price. You know, us kids that have been through it pay a price as well. And sometimes those things go unseen for years and years, and they sometimes manifest themselves later on in life.
It's interesting how most, you know, children that grow up in a nuclear home where divorce is not present, you just have mom, dad, and the kids, and all the children have different stories to tell about their own upbringing based on the when they were born, whether they're first born, middle, last. And it's the same thing happens when if you're a child of divorce, except now you extend it out, because whereas in a family that is just mom, dad, and the kids, they argue about the attention they got, or mom loved you more, dad liked you more, that whole thing. Well, now it's expanded because now you've got mom and dad, plus oftentimes their extended spouses and other half brothers and half sisters, that it becomes a big fray. And some kids have a way of maneuvering through it better than others.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd agree. And it's like a race. You're jockeying for, I never know what validation actually means. People use that term all the time. I never really know what it is.
Oh, approval.
But you're jockeying. Yeah. Approval. Yeah.
I've always thought of that. We all want to approval. We want it from our mom and dad first and foremost. And you know what? I wondered, Joe, in this particular case, because I've covered it too. When it first began, as a missing person, what happened to this 13-year-old kid?
Right.
A 13-year-old boy, Dylan Redwine, goes to visit his dad. Now, his mom and dad were divorced, and Dylan did not want to go. That was made pretty public fairly early in this whole case, but it was Thanksgiving. He had to go there to be with his dad for Thanksgiving. It was court-ordered, so Dylan Redwine went. He arrives at the airport in Colorado. Dad picks him up. We have CCTV coverage. That's how intense this case got. We saw them at Walmart. We saw them at McDonald's. You don't see them being overly warm with one another. There was a little distance while they were walking, but you couldn't really see a whole lot. But the bottom line, always being the bottom line, Dylan Redwine did reach out to a friend and was going to meet him the next morning. Now he's at dad's house. And one thing to point out, Mark Redwine, the father, his home had burned about 6 months earlier, and it had recently been remodeled. And this was the first time that Dylan had really been there since it had been remodeled. And that means something, by the way, as we go further into this case, right, forensically speaking. So Dylan Redwine is at this house. It wasn't unfamiliar territory. He did have friends there, and he called a friend, or he reached out to a friend in the evening, and they made plans for the next morning at 6:30 a.m. They were going to get together. Now, something 13-year-old boys do. You know, when you're 13 and you've got the woods, open area, you can get out there and just, I know I did it, but that's an age that, you know what, as a man now, I wanted to make sure my boys got it, and I want to make sure my grandson gets it, that there is something beautiful, like going out in the woods at 13 and challenging yourself to, you know, what can you do?
Yeah, amazing. Climbing a tree, trying to get back without an open wound bleeding.
Right. know, without doing anything to get in trouble, but you have a knife. Usually you have a knife, though, just in case.
Yeah. You have a knife. You're going to chop wood do some whittling, or you're going to play army.
Yeah. Just an adventure.
It is. It is a grand adventure. And you look at that and you think, and for kids of divorce, that's the ultimate fantasy world, isn't it? Because you can get out there and you can.
Never put that together, Joe.
You can escape. You can escape from the tension that's in the house. And interesting, just kind of a little aside here. I used to watch this show inside the actor studio, where the guy would interview the James Lipton. He's passed on now, but he would interview these actors. And there was one thing that he would always start off with in these interviews, and he would say, we're going to come to a common theme now that is a thread that runs through all of our guests here. You are a child of divorce. And I would think about that, and I thought, wow, where does some of this, cause I don't really know that many actors. I've got some friends that are, but not close friends, but you think about, where do they get all this raw emotion from and all these things? And I know, as a divorce kid, there is a lot of raw emotion. There's a lot of stuff that you have to work out, work through in your mind. And I don't know, maybe some are drawn toward the theater, because just for a moment, you can escape whatever your perception of your reality is at that moment. And at Thanksgiving, imagine Dylan having to be away from the safety of his home with his mother. Where he wanted to be.
And interesting to point out, not only did he not want to be with his dad, the last few times they had been together had been very tension-filled, to the point where Dylan no longer felt comfortable around his dad. Plus, Dylan and Corey is Dylan's brother, they had found pictures on a computer of their dad.
Yeah.
This divorce was already ugly, okay? Just throwing it out. It was already ugly. And apparently Dylan and Corey both had seen some legal documents that painted a very direct picture of what was being claimed by their dad, by their mom. But it was the pictures they saw on this computer that actually made them realize, this is not a guy we want to be around. And Dylan did not want to be there, and he had this in the back of his head. And by the way, Mark knew it. He knew it.
Yeah, the father had a complete and total awareness, and I just so you know, I made reference to how, and I don't want to make this about me, but just to kind of give you the background, when I was asked to cover this case, and I was actually, I cover cases on Court TV, I cover cases on the Law and Crime Network, and I have friends at both places whom I care for deeply, and I'll be friends with many of them for life. Law and Crime asked me to cover this case, and they send you this kind of this big packet, when you're going through it. And when you begin to look at the notes of what you're going to cover. And I begin to read through this thing and I'm thinking, okay, missing young boy, remains have been found in, you know, two separate locations. They're skeletonized. He's missing for a time. Oh, and then there's these pictures and I'm thinking, oh, okay, well, what are the pictures? And then I had to do a double take when I began to read about them because, you know, these pictures, when you're thinking about forensic psychology, there are certain roles that people think about from a sexual standpoint. People have, I don't want to call them predispositions. That's not necessarily what they do, but they are what are referred to as paraphilias. And this, there is a particular paraphilia that is out there that's actually called coprophilia. And it is a fascination. I hate to say this on my own show, but it's a fascination with feces, in particular human feces. And if you can imagine, you're a divorced kid, you're scared, you've got tension between your parents, and you travel along with your brother Corey to your father's house months prior to your disappearance, and you're digging through your dad's computer, as you had mentioned, and you come across a file, and you look at that file. You're in the bathroom with your brother, the door is locked, and you click on it, and there are images of your father dressed in women's lingerie with makeup on and human feces spread all over his face, eating from a diaper. Dave, have you ever heard of someone saying, I almost died of embarrassment? You ever heard that phrase before?
I've used it before.
Yeah, I have too.
You were talking about theater and actors a minute ago, and I was thinking, okay, now you're naming my life. Did you get my bio? Yeah, and it was during one of those times where I thought I was going to be so embarrassed I was going to die.
Yeah, it does happen. And look, there we commit any number of faux pas in life. You know, things we say, things we shouldn't do, or we exit the bathroom and toilet paper is hanging out of the backside of our pants or stuck to our shoe, or we've got spinach in our teeth, or, you know, or in my case, when I saw a friend of mine I hadn't seen in years and years, this lady that I was dear friends with when I was a child, and I saw her and she said, oh, I'm pregnant. And I said, I know. And she said, I just found out yesterday. And so the meaning is that she had physically changed greatly and I hadn't seen her in years. So increased in size. And I felt, you know, I turned 50 shades of red and was very embarrassed for having said that. And, you know, I followed it up with telling her that I love that I thought that she looked lovely. And of course I'm tripping over my tongue the entire time. But when you get to the degree that Dylan's father was at, particularly with these, this paraphilia that he engaged in, and you document it photographically, you save these images so that I guess that you can live out this kind of fantastical life when it's not going on. And then suddenly, your children find out about it. I would think that would be, I don't know, an impetus for a rage-filled event, perhaps?
There was an interesting twist on this that the boys, Corey and Mark, Corey and Dylan are the boys. They kept it to themselves at first. They didn't immediately challenge dad. They didn't immediately go to him and say, what are you doing? Who are you? And they held it. They didn't know what to do. I mean, they're kids.
Yeah, how's a kid going to know what to say to this?
So imagine, here's Dylan. And by the way, Dylan and his father were together on a trip to Boston to play baseball. It was a Little League thing that Dylan was a part of. And it was on this trip when Mark or Dylan and Corey both had been talking about confronting their father about these pictures. And Dylan apparently had decided he was going to use this trip to Boston to confront him. And he texted Corey, send me the pictures. Corey didn't send him the pictures. I don't know whether he decided I'm not going to let Dylan do it. I'm going to do it. Corey didn't send the pictures to Dylan. He sent these pictures to their dad on this trip. And he wrote some pretty, they were, from an insulting standpoint, they were pretty awesome. I don't remember how old Corey is. Dylan was 13. But Corey wrote, you are what you eat, to his dad with these pictures that he showed him. So now on this trip to Boston, Mark Redwine realizes that both of his sons, or at least Corey, knows about the pictures because Corey sent them to him. All I could think of is that at some point in time, you mentioned that it's an actual issue. I didn't realize that, Joe. I thought, you know, there's all kinds of perversions and things that people get into, but apparently, you know, he was in the closet with this, didn't want anybody to know about it. And you've got pictures of him wearing a red bra, makeup, and a diaper filled with Indian food, you know, eaten by a child first.
Yeah.
And it boggles my mind.
Yeah, it's actually horrible. I've seen not just the crime scene photos, but I've seen these seen these images that are, you know, that are essentially the little spark that created the flame for everything. And here's an interesting bit of forensic data that arose, because there's a whole line of texting messages that went through, that kind of ran up the spine of this whole case. When Corey, the older brother, sent that text to his father, interestingly enough, Mark wrote back and responded to Corey.
And, oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he said, you know, and this is after after Corey had told him that he's a coward, that he was nothing more than a sperm donor. And then Mark actually texts back to Corey, the father, and says, telling him not to hurt his brother. Now, he's telling the older brother not to hurt the younger brother. And, you know, I guess he's saying, you know, don't show him, or, you know, don't show him these photos, thinking that Corey's the only one to see him. But, you know, going to what you had said earlier, you know, there's kind of a disconnect in these follow-up visits that he was having. Dylan had already seen him.
Right.
This child already had these images, you know, in his mind.
And that's what I was going to ask you, Joe, because you've covered this more. I thought I had covered it a lot until I looked at what you've done with this case. And I hate it for you because I've had nightmares about this one. But
it's horrible.
When I saw this, and again, my brother and I were, he's 2 years older than I am, when my parents were going through a divorce. And then it's not just the divorce, it's the things that happen after the divorce.
Yeah.
And that's what we're dealing with here, is the aftermath. Even though mom and dad didn't seem to do a good job of keeping the boys uninvolved in the divorce, they were very involved. They knew everything that was going on. They're old enough to know, I guess. But when I believe, based on what I have seen, that Mark Redwine actually believed, yes, Corey has these, don't share them with your little brother, don't hurt him, let's keep this between you and me and we'll deal with it. He was trying to save face, I thought. All the while, he doesn't know that Dylan has seen these pictures and actually wants to confront him about them, but they had already been having a bad time together, as you mentioned. So do you think that their relationship was so off kilter that Mark Redwine, the father, didn't realize that Dylan Redwine not only saw the pictures, but had formulated his own opinion, and that was what was causing the friction in their relationship? Or was he so deluded as to think, I can turn Dylan to be back on my side in this divorce and, you know, we'll just fight it that way?
No, I think that at this point in time, you know, probably Mark Redwine realized that he had crossed the Rubicon with this. And I think that more than likely he's trying to understand and figure out what he should do next. I think that along with this comes this level of humiliation and concurrently anger. And he's going to strike out. Remember that, you know, he had been texting, you had mentioned going to Boston for baseball. That was back on August the 5th, 2012. It's November the 18th. Remember, you talked about Thanksgiving. It's November the 18th. He's had to make a trip to his dad. This is Dylan by himself. And he arrives at his dad. The last time he's known to be alive is November the 18th, 2012. So you've got all of this time, August to November, for all of this stuff to bubble up. And who knows what's going on from a communication standpoint during that period of time. Is communication becoming less frequent? Do you have, angry messages flying back and forth? What's being said on the phone for one another? And so all of this plays into trying to determine where Dylan is at this point in time. Once he goes missing on November the 18th and he's under the care of his father, the dad, Mark Redwine, says he had left to go out and run errands. And in fact, when he got home, he said that, Dylan wasn't there. He wasn't there, couldn't find him anywhere. And so that's troubling. There was some activity on Dylan's phone. I think probably the last phone activity was about 9 p.m. on November the 18th. Who knows who was actually using the phone at that point in time to communicate with his friend. Dylan was supposed to go meet up with his buddy. And of course, that never happened.
I would like to point out Corey Redwine is actually several years older than Dylan. Right. Corey Redwine actually was 20 years old, give or take, when this was going on.
Reached that age of emancipation where if he doesn't want to go to dad's house, he doesn't have to go.
Well, I looked up because I was wondering why. Why is it? Because that had always troubled me, and I was like, well, wait a minute, he was considerably older, and that's also why he was so confrontational with his dad, and it also makes sense as to why Mark would address him almost as a peer, as an adult, saying, "Don't hurt your little brother," but seeing him as much younger, not realizing that Dylan's the one that found the photos to start with and told Corey about them. But now you've got the discussion where we've got the text messages from Dylan to his friend the evening before. The next morning, Mark claims he goes out to run errands, and when he got home, Dylan was gone. That's the scenario that he played out and stayed with. This is where the world of forensics boggles my mind, Joe. It really does, because I had no idea. I had no idea of what you guys are capable of figuring out, not just the next day, the next week, the next month, but months and months. I mean, what can still be found out? What's left behind? There is no perfect crime.
No, there's not. There is no perfect crime. You can't do anything in a vacuum. And I always reflect back. I know I've referenced this before. In the book of Genesis where, God calls out to Cain and says, tells Cain, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. And in this particular case, you've got Dylan's blood is actually found within the home. And it's not, later reports forensically indicate that it is apparently not to the level or volume that would necessarily be an event that is consistent with incompatibility with life, where you've just got a tremendous amount of blood that's there that maybe there was an attempt to clean up, but they found some on a coffee table. They found some on a sofa. There was actually some beneath the carpet. And interestingly enough, it was a dog that found the blood, within the home. And dogs are so fascinating. You talk about us as forensic investigators, but when you have an animal at your disposal that has this incredible olfactory, I call it an olfactory spectrum. I know that people that are working ophthalmology will probably laugh about that, but that's what I refer to it as. It's a spectrum of smell that they have that we as humans can't even begin to touch. And they are specially trained. And on a side that folks might not know, when I worked with a medical examiner, we would have a lady that would come by periodically, and she would go back into our decomp area, and she had rags that she would soak up decomp fluid out of the trays where the body sat and seal them, and then take those rags out into the woods and smear the trees with decomp fluid to train her dogs with, so that they would know what decomposing human remnants smelt like. And so these dogs are trained. You've got two separate groups of them. You've got them that will track the living. Okay. You think bloodhounds and those sorts of things. And then you have cadaver dogs. And so, well, what's considered to be a cadaver dog? Well, postmortem, there has to be some level of decay that's there because it's on a different olfactory spectrum, if you will. And they hit on these things. They can even pick up on the smell. Blood actually has a foul odor in and of itself, even as it decomposes. And so they'll hit along that spectrum and they'll be able to track, but just within the house alone, they found Dylan's blood. And here's the thing we're talking about. This is not like this would have been necessarily old blood, because what did you say in the beginning, Dave? This man's house had burned. It had been renovated. So this sample that would have been in there would have been something that probably would have been placed down in that area or would have been introduced into that environment post-renovation, post-fire. So that narrows it down, because the fire, if I remember, took place like back in March of 2012, and Dylan goes missing November the 12th. And you're left wondering, well, why would you have multiple spots of this child's blood in this home that, you know, he's not domiciled there. He doesn't live there all the time. So, you know, you can explain it. I mean, I've had a spontaneous bloody nose over the course of my life. Heck, I've busted my head on different things and, you know, had an open bleeding wound. Yeah, that does happen. And certainly, you know, being a qualified former little boy, I know that I've spouted blood any number of ways, but you know, it from an investigative standpoint, how do you get past that? This is one of those moments in time where you have to ask bigger questions. And one of the things that we do know, this little boy was nowhere in that house. But something tells me the dogs are going to play a key role in discovering Dylan's remains. Dave, I think if I ever do a podcast, maybe as an adjunct to Body Bags, where we just do a little separate one, I think I might use the title Corpus Delicti. I've always liked that term. It comes from the Latin, and it means the body of the crime. But many times it is in fact the body. And there's been a lot of people that have said you can't prosecute a homicide without a body. And I think that for investigators in the Dylan Redwine case, they were wondering if they suspected something was up, but they knew that they had to find this child's body if they were ever going to move forward with a case. And certainly moving forward without a body is a problem.
So Dylan goes missing November 19, 2012. They don't find him. There was weather situations to deal with regard to being able to put out a search for him. It wasn't until the following year in 2013 when, and it was the femur, but it was both femurs, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Now, what are the odds of finding that, you know, something so specific, leg bones, finding everything? It just seems odd.
Yeah, it kind of does to me too.
But that's what they found in 2013.
Yeah, it was actually in June. So this is going to be after everything is thawed. Remember, okay, we're in a higher elevation,
right,
in Colorado. It's to say that Colorado winters are brutal is certainly an understatement. It's terrifying. That weather, you know, during those periods of time, right? And, you know, when Dylan went missing, they were right on the cusp, mm-hmm, of that moment in time. I think that they'd already had some snowfall when Dylan had gone missing back in 12.
Right.
But moving forward, you know, you have to get out beyond that period, the thaw, before you're going to find anything. And what did occur is that I think it was roughly 10 miles away from Mark Redwine's home that the left and the right femurs are actually found. So if you,
and they were found on a road, Joe.
Yeah.
That was odd. They found, and it was 8 miles from his house.
Okay.
8 miles from his house. They find the bones, but they're on a road. Why would they find bones on a road in June?
Yeah. And so that to me, many times if temperature drops, okay, you'll have the body that will go into, it won't stop decomposing, but it will slow the decompositional process down a bit, particularly if temperatures at a high elevation really start to dip. And so they could have been deposited off of the road some distance, say on an ATV trail. And we do know that Mark Redwine had an ATV, and they're deposited there. And then once an animal begins to smell these decomposing remains, remember they're actually found in June. There's nothing to say that an animal would not have come by, grabbed this lower portion of the body. And it's not just the lower portion of the body. When they found the left and right femurs, they actually found the right clavicle. So if you're listening to my voice right now, it's your collarbone, and it's your right collarbone. That's what they found of Dylan's. And in addition to that, they found the tibia, which is one of the lower leg bones. There's two. You have the tibia and the fibula that are in the lower leg. Well, they found the right tibia. So you've got two, and it's an odd combination in it, Dave. You've got the left and the right femur, which are the large, robust bones in the legs. You've got the right clavicle, which is the collarbone. And then you've got this right tibia. So, you know, as forensic scientists, you know, one of the things that you're thinking about, once this has been identified as human remains, you can't necessarily say that it belongs to a specific person at that point in time. But when you begin to examine these and you're thinking, well, why do I only have these items? Well, am I looking at a case where we've got an animal that has torn a body apart, or do I have a case where another animal, a human, has torn a body apart and deposited the parts in various areas? And so, you know, you begin to think about this. If it's a human, then one of the things that you're going to look for on the surface of the bones are going to be tool marks, because that's what we do. We've got opposable thumbs and we work with tools. And so if you're going to take apart a human body, you're going to need the tools to do that. And it's very, I don't know of any possible way that you could dismember a human remain without utilizing some kind of metal tool in order to do that. So these bones would have to be carefully examined to, you know, kind of either rule that in or rule it out.
Now, one thing they did is after they found the bones in June of 2013, it took a couple of weeks, but in August, about 8 weeks after they find those bones, they're able to search the house and the truck. That's when they bring in the cadaver dogs. A human cadaver dog is brought into Mark Redwine's home, and that's where the dogs were hitting on, saying that there had been the corpse of a deceased person had been present. That's the actual, the way they wrote it out. It had been present in that home, also in the bed of his truck. And this was after they'd found those bones, but they didn't find all of them. And one comment Mark Redwine made to a friend of his that really came back to haunt him before they found anything, Mark Redwine made the comment. I guess they were talking about, how do you charge anybody, you know, if he was killed? If he, you know, just, I'm trying to picture a conversation you would have with somebody that would include the term blunt force trauma from a dad talking about his son when he doesn't know what has happened to his son. Why? For the life of me, I can't figure out. Joe, that's just not a term I would want to use about a loved one, much less would even think about using. But he did. Mark Redwine talked about blunt force trauma and, well, they'd need to find his head, talking about police, in order to determine that his son had been murdered by blunt force trauma. Well, they'd need to find his head.
Yeah. How is it that you're comfortable enough to make that comment? And it's so very specific. You know, you can reformulate that to talk about, well, you know, I hope they find my son's body and maybe there'll be information contained on it that'll let us know what happened. Okay. That's kind of the sympathetic view. But then you begin to look at this from the perspective of, well, you're being very specific here, very specific, because blunt force is something that we normally talk about in the realm of forensics and specifically forensic pathology. And it has such a fine point on it, and not just fine point when you're talking about method that is used, but also, Dave, when you begin to think about anatomical location, because he states, you know, that you'd have to find the skull, and you know, I'm sure much to his chagrin, Dylan's skull was actually found. Well, what turned out to be Dylan's skull, hikers actually found the skull on November the 3rd, 2015, and it took them all the way to May the 25th of 2016 to get the skull positively identified at that point in time.
Why would it take so long? But I do want to add something to this too, Joe.
Yeah.
All right. They made a note where the partial remains were found in June 2013. They go and discover the cadaver dogs hitting in the house and in the truck bed. And then the hikers, almost 3 years, November 3rd, 2015, right, is just about 3 years after he goes missing. They find his skull, and it's now further away. It's it's about 10 miles from the house. And the one thing that Mark Redwine had said out loud is he believed wild animals had attacked and had drug him. And one of the experts, a wildlife expert, actually determined that, quote, no animal known to be in the area would transport a body up the mountain from Mr. Redwine's residence to the first recovery site, or would transport the skull an additional 1.5 miles through the terrain where the skull was found. Yeah, this was not in the indictment.
Yeah, they're not going to do that. And I concur with the expert in this case. And in my experience with where you have what are referred to as a surface deposition of human remains, which means these are non buried remains. These are remains that are left on top of the ground. Now, I'm not saying that at some point in time the remains could not have been buried and then kind of dug up, but if these
you call
are
it surface deposition?
Yeah, surface deposition. And essentially what that means is that if you think about, okay, I'll give you a good example. Think about Brian Laundrie. Okay, they found him out in the swamps. Well, when Brian Laundrie's remains were found out in the swamp, his body was not buried. That's a surface deposition of the body in total. Now, with these remains, it's over such a massive area. And Dave, it's not like, you know, here in the deep South, we're going to walk down a dirt road together, carrying something in our hand and throw out one item here and throw another. You're talking about undulating, uneven terrain that rises and falls at pitches we can't even fathom, particularly those of us that are flatlanders that live in these areas around here. The terrain varies so much. Most animals, when they scavenge, and this is one other thing before I forget it, I wanted to mention, when Dylan died or was turned up missing, it was shortly after that I think that Mark Redwine had put forth this idea that perhaps a bear had gotten him. But the experts, and this gives you an idea of the temperatures at this time, the experts said that by the time that Dylan had gone missing in November of 12, the bears would have gone into hibernation by that time. So they're not out and about. And you compare this to the Morphew case. What did Barry Morphew say about his wife? Well, mountain lion got her. Yeah.
But there's only three. They're very territorial, and there are only three in the area, and that one was nowhere near where he was.
Yeah, isn't it interesting how people blame animals for these sorts of things? And with most surface depositions of skeletal remains, where you have bodies, let's just put it this way, where you have bodies that are you have bodies that are intact. Okay. That means that nothing has been done with them. As they decay on the ground, animals will come and they'll generally start in areas that they can get access to. So if you've got a clothed body, they're going to go for the face. They're going to go for the fingers. All right. And they start to pull. And as the body begins to deteriorate, things are more easily pulled apart till they begin to tear at the clothing. Now, some of Dylan's clothing was found. There were remnant of clothing out there, including, I think, shoes as well. But here's the thing. You're not going to have them spreading remains over this vast, uneven terrain. And I think the skull, what was, okay, so the lower remains, this deposition of the femurs, 8 miles away, along with the clavicle and the tibia. That's 8 miles away. You've got to go another mile and a half
up,
you know, increasing in elevation where you're going to find his head. It, you know, as they say down here in the South, that dog don't hunt. And so it's just one of those things that it defies all logic. Animals are not going to drag. If they're in a particular area, kind of scavenging, they're going to grab whatever they can grab. They're going to take it back. And the smaller animals, you know, you can forget about that, because if you're talking about coyotes, these are not huge, robust animals where they're going to walk miles and miles. And it's not like the savannas of Africa where a lion or something, they're not going to walk miles and miles and miles with something that they're going to eat. They're going to go very short distances, sit down, and they're going to begin to ingest their food.
So if that is what happened, this makes no sense. But what does make sense is you've got body parts, you've got his remains found at 8 miles away, then a mile and a half up the mountain, you find his skull. But what did they find on the skull, Joe? Because We remember Mark Redwine made the comment, well, they can't do anything without the head, and he mentioned that's where the blunt force trauma came in. By the way, still an unexplainable comment that he made, and it has been brought up at court. It was brought up in each stage along this way, because who would say that other than somebody guilty of doing such a thing? But what did that skull tell investigators?
Well, baseline, they were finally able to get Dylan's remains identified off of skull.
Back to that. You said, okay, they found the skull in November.
Yeah.
But it was May of the next year before they could even identify it.
And the images that I've seen of the skull seems like that it would make dental ID very, very difficult on him. By the time you're Dylan's age in life, you will have had some type of dentistry performed. Many people might not know this. I'm sure that DNA came into play in Dylan's case, but did you know that there are certain cases where we're trying to identify bodies, if we don't have teeth, we'll actually forensic odontologists who look at the dental x-rays. I've been involved in cases where we use the sinuses to identify people. So you can do a comparison between sinuses of antemortem x-rays with postmortem x-rays of the skull. So if you've got, you know, you've got sinuses throughout your head, they're not just anterior, you have some posterior as well. There are these little chambers in your body, and they have certain patterns. When you look at them on radiographs, x-rays, you can actually compare antemortem with postmortem images, and you can get x-rays. You can use that as a starting point to get the identification done. A forensic anthropologist will take the skull and they'll begin to do measurements in a very broad sense. So when you're a 13-year-old, your skull has not fully matured at that point to the same size that it's going to be when you're a full-grown adult. So there are certain measurements that forensic anthropologists will make in order to determine, does this individual fit it within this demographic that we're looking for? We're talking about a 13-year-old white male. Does this skull that we have even begin to marginally fit into that? And so you begin to narrow down from there. But further examination by the forensic anthropologist found four items that are of significance. First off, they found evidence of these kind of what we refer to as curvilinear fractures on the skull. And when I say curvilinear, it's a fancy way of saying that you've got these fractures that are kind of in a line, but they also slightly curve. And that gives you an idea that and they're separate. They're not communicating, which means that they do not touch one another. Those are two specific areas of blunt force trauma that Dylan would have sustained, and these were located in the back of the head. The skull fractures do not appear to be depressed skull fractures where the plug of bone has been knocked down in there, but it's enough potentially of a concussive force that it could kill him. And here's the other thing that will send a chill up your spine about this. Remember how we were going on about how these remains were separated? Well, Dave, one of the things that the forensic anthropologist found on Dylan's skull were two tiny linear tool marks that are consistent with a knife blade. So what does that tell us? Why would this child have knife blade marks on the external table of his skull? Now, one of the defense experts at Mark Redwine's trial actually put forth the idea, well, that's probably from an animal. The teeth marks of an animal look completely different than a milled edge of a blade, and these things are very uniformed. You can tell that this was generated by a tool. So the big question you have to ask, after Mark Redwine was put to shame as a result of what his boys had discovered, after he thinks about it for some time, about what he's going to do, did he allow that kernel to be planted within his brain that drove him into such a fit of rage that he would get his son by himself on a Thanksgiving holiday, get him in that house alone, beat him to death, and destroy his mortal remains? I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bags.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.